fifth case this morning, Cross v. Ramos. Ms. Eisner?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Emily Eisner, as counsel for Appellant Irving Cross. May it please the Court. The issues in this case, which is a denial of habeas corpus relief, are the lack of good faith in dispensing with live testimony and the facts that violate my client's right to confrontation. Here we have and start with an absent complaining witness in a rape prosecution who is not permanently unavailable in the constitutional sense, with the state not acting in good faith to produce her. What happened was the first jury was partly acquitted my client, was hung on the remaining counts, whereupon the prosecutor did not secure her presence for retrial, even though the prosecutor knew she was important and knew she did not want to testify. And the parties even put on the record that in front of the first jury, she had been distracted, uninterested, hesitating, spacey, extremely scared or nervous, and with a demeanor labeled extraordinarily bizarre, and whom the judge conceded had taken 2 minutes to answer every question, and whom the state knew was pale and depressed when informed of the mistrial and need to testify again, and further knew that she had a lifestyle that could make her transient and elusive of authority. And yet they laid back, which let her get away. They never put her under subpoena when they could have. They never had her admonished, warned of a bench warrant by the judge. They never maintained contact. They let 4 months elapse, did not start looking for her until the eve of retrial. And on top of all that, did not look very long, merely a couple of weeks, a week or so, approximately 3 weeks at the most, knowing all along that they stood to benefit by a new and improved actress to read the transcript in place of her, by someone whose demeanor was not distracted, hesitating, and uninterested, by an employee from the prosecutor's own office who could read and did read the sexual episodes with some inflection in her voice. In contrast,
the judge indicated that he would ask both sides to come up with somebody agreeable.
What happened was that they did not agree. They did not agree at all. The defense wanted a neutral court reporter. That was obviously didn't want the transcript at all, but once lost that point, a disinterested neutral court reporter, and over defense objection, it was not to be. So then the actual reader of the transcript was the replacement, and so the second jury, never saw the actual complainant and never heard her. Your Honors, when examining and determining good faith, this court is, and Illinois was, required to look at the totality of the material facts, because context is key in Ohio versus Roberts and Barber v. Page, that make it the state's obligation to bring the witness to trial. But here, the Illinois courts unreasonably believed that context was irrelevant or, quote, not required, and that context could be refused to be weighed. Even worse, the Illinois appellate court thought it was prohibited from considering context by the Illinois legislature. The Illinois court's clearly saying that its hands were tied by Illinois' hearsay rule. In particular, the Illinois appellate court appeared sympathetic to our points, but was saying that the Illinois legislature does not allow them to attribute any of this against the state, neither the importance of the witness as the sole eyewitness and accuser in a rape case, neither the importance of a demeanor in a rape case where credibility is key, neither the fact that there was this record of incredible demeanor that gave the prosecutor a motive to dispense with live testimony, neither the state's failure to subpoena the witness because it's not inflexibly required in every case, neither the state's failure to maintain contact with the witness because it, too, is not inflexibly required, neither the reason or recency for the witness's absence, which the state knew about and which makes the state complicit and at least gives them unclean hands. So
is there any undercutting of your position by the fact that it wasn't a straight across the board conviction? There was an acquittal of some counts and conviction of others.
Well, no, because the issue isn't double jeopardy. The issue is really the point that...
It's not
that
double jeopardy, but I mean that the jury was discriminating and found him not guilty as to certain counts.
But found him guilty of criminal sexual assault, and that the only jury who ever saw convicted him, and the other jury never convicted him of anything. So that's the contrast that we're asking your honors to look at. So in sum, and in short, the Illinois courts refused to consider the context, the totality of the surrounding circumstances, combining the factors, in fact, never considered them even one by one, to see the pattern of the prosecutor's behavior and the really what became deliberate harm to my client, which was avoidable and foreseeable by the state, which we are urging this court to remedy.
And Dick? Sorry, Ms. Bending.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leah Bendick from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of Respondent Warden Ramos. This court should affirm denial of habeas relief because the state appellate court reasonably applied standards from Supreme Court case law in concluding that the state did make a good faith effort to locate the victim, A.S., so that she was properly deemed an unavailable witness for Sixth Amendment purposes. Here, the state appellate court correctly and with great detail on page 48 of its opinion set forth the proper standard for evaluating this type of claim and reasonably concluded that A.S. was unavailable given the extensive efforts that the state put forth in order to locate her.
And those extensive efforts were basically interviewing her family?
Interviewing her family as well as checking with her ex-boyfriend's family and rendering numerous checks with state, federal, and county agencies to attempt to locate whether there was a death certificate, whether she was in the hospital, whether she had sought benefits at the Department of Public Aid. They checked with the Immigration Department in case there was a border crossing.
And what about this beauty school she was supposed to attend or some of the places, some of the corners she did her business on?
According to the state appellate court, as to the intersections that you're referencing, the state appellate court found that there was insufficient record evidence that there were known specific intersections about alleged prostitution. But even putting that aside, the likelihood that such a lead would put forth any useful information is doubtful, given the fact that in Ohio versus Roberts, the Supreme Court stated that the state need not take futile actions, and furthermore, that the affirmative steps that are taken are evaluated under a sort of a reasonableness standard.
Well, I'll take it she didn't have, they didn't check the phone records or anything. I realize that cell phones weren't quite the rage then, but there was no check of, like, phone calls to her mother's home.
I don't believe so, but according to the mother, when Detective Jaglowski, a Chicago police detective, spoke with her on March 28th, the mother stated that they had spoken by phone, A.S. and the mother, approximately on March 14th, that was the last time the mother had spoken with A.S. And during that phone call, A.S. had told her mother that she was frightened and that she did not intend to return to the city. And the mother responded to that by asking the detective how she could file a missing persons report. And according to the mother, there had been no other in-person or otherwise phone call contacts between her and her mother. And her mother's house was her residence at the time. And also to reference the school, that was another thing you had brought up in your previous question. According to the mother, in that same conversation, the mother told the detective that she had not attended in some time, which further shows the improbability, if not futility, of pursuing that lead.
And the phone record, when she did call in that one time, they didn't pull the record for that?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think the record actually is silent on that matter, but it is not confirmed by the record.
What's the record evidence to show this activity supporting the search for her?
There was a hearing on March 28th, 2000, before the trial judge, and there was the testimony at that hearing by the three individuals that the state's attorney's office had enlisted to look for her, that being the Mary Ember, an investigator from the office, Claudia Morales, a victim witness advocate, and also Detective Jeglowski at the Chicago Police Department. So all three witnesses testified about their efforts during the interim of approximately March 10th through March 28th. And furthermore, there is also testimony that the mistrial from the first trial was declared on I believe it was November 3rd, 1999, and within 48 hours, the prosecutor made sure to meet in person with A.S. and her mother to talk with her about what happened and to secure her agreement to testify again.
And so why wasn't a subpoena served on her then? Why didn't a police officer? I mean, because that's when she showed that reluctance, right?
Well, it had also been true before the first trial that she seemed reluctant, but she agreed, and she did testify at the
first.
But
haven't things changed a little now that we're at a second trial? I'm sure that her demeanor, you're right. The record shows that she was reluctant before, but now you've had a mistrial, gone back a second time. There's a reason the prosecutor went there to try to get some assurance. A subpoena would have guaranteed that, or might have guaranteed it, let me put it that way. And it wasn't served, and then there could have been a material witness warrant issued if she failed to appear.
Those are steps that the state could have taken. However, as the district court noted in considering this issue, given her willingness before the second trial to testify again, there was, as the district court put it, no apparent reason to put her under subpoena at that point. Because after all, in Ohio versus Roberts, the Supreme Court has confirmed that it is a totality of the circumstances test, that if there are affirmative actions that could produce the witness, that they, quote, may be required, not that they are always required.
So I take it it's not a standard practice to serve witnesses with subpoenas? Or it wasn't at that time? Because, I mean, that is a good practice for a prosecutor's office to just serve the witnesses, generally speaking, whether they're reluctant or not. That way, if for whatever reason they fail to appear, you can always get a warrant.
I see your point. I'm not sure the record reflects what the practice was at that time. It's worth noting that since she was frightened and she agreed to testify, perhaps the prosecutor would have thought that a subpoena would only frighten her more, that having a conversation with her mother, at which she again agreed to testify, where they knew her location, they knew the time period between the two trials was very short. She was 19 years old and was enrolled in school, so there was no reason to think that she was about to leave the jurisdiction as the state knew it at that time. And so certainly if this were a case that this court were to find that a subpoena were required, what case would there not be a subpoena requirement? Since she had agreed to testify, her location was known previously, and as soon as she was absent from the jurisdiction, they took all the steps they could to attempt to locate her. And so given the lack of knowledge at that point of where she was, the subpoena would have been futile.
But, I guess the problem I have is she was really the key and really the only witness in the trial. And to, not put her under subpoena as an automatic thing, as a matter of routine, is that the practice now?
I'm afraid I don't know what the practice is now, but it is a totality of the circumstances test, and three factors weigh against the subpoena being too heavy.
All I'm suggesting is that this, you would have more evidence here if there had been a subpoena that was issued, and a good standard practice is to issue such a subpoena.
That's true, Your Honor. However, it still remains that because she had agreed prior to the first trial, even though she seemed reluctant at that point, she had followed through on her promise, and she did testify.
I understand that. And my question is really aside. It's not really the record, but I know that was a practice in the U.S. Attorney's Office when I was there. We always subpoenaed people in the event that somebody would fail to appear, whether they were cooperative, uncooperative, or whatever, and then you could always bring them in if they failed to appear. That's all I'm suggesting, that you can avoid in the future, or at least lessen some of the burden on the prosecutor's office when such a subpoenas are issued.
That is certainly a fair point. I would also point the court, however, to page 27 and 28 of the appellee's brief, which provide citations to cases in which witnesses were found to be unavailable even though a subpoena had not been issued. And certainly, given that there were multiple steps taken here by three individuals, the state had put forth extensive efforts and resources to find this, to find AS. And also given the fact that the checks were made according to her name, her social security number, her description, her date of birth, even known aliases, the fact that there were multiple visits made by Detective Jaglowski approximately every third day in the course of about a three-week period to her residence at all hours of day and night, so that, according to Detective Jaglowski, if she were somehow hiding there, given his persistence, he would have discovered her. Because prior to her disappearance, she had agreed to testify and had followed through on that promise before. That was certainly reasonable for the state to rely on that. But as soon as they knew she was missing, and given their persistent efforts to find her, at that point a subpoena would not have changed the outcome or necessarily brought her in. And this should be contrasted with the Ohio versus Roberts case, because in that case there were only two steps taken by the state. They spoke to her interested parents to see where the witness Anita was, and they issued subpoenas after they had been told that she was out of state. And yet they did not pursue a lead of a San Francisco social worker who had contacted them, and yet it was found to be unavailable.
Moving to the demeanor, lack of demeanor evidence by the reading of the transcript, the idea that it was somebody from the state's attorney's office, is that right, read the transcript?
I believe it was a clerk or an intern, yes.
I was going to say, from what I understand, at least reading some of the comments here, there was long pauses prior to answering the question. Were those inserted as well?
I do not believe so. If I may have a moment to address that point. Yes, certainly. Thank you, Your Honor. I would point out that, yes, the trial judge confirmed that she had some hesitance in her answers. However, the quotes that opposing counsel used today, spacey and frightened, and those quotes to describe her demeanor, are only gleaned from descriptions from defense counsel at the hearing on unavailability. As far as I know, those are the record sites that she relies upon. And so certainly that is a biased individual who, in trying to find her unavailable, was describing her demeanor. So that should be at least considered. And certainly in every case in which a transcript is used, there is a loss of demeanor evidence. But looking at pages 50 and 53 of the state appellate court opinion, the court did weigh that factor, and because the court set forth the proper standard and there were such extensive efforts by the state in compared to Ohio versus Roberts, certainly on the deferential habeas standard, the finding of unavailability should be considered a reasonable one.
But then when you add to that, there's some indication there were inflections almost acting by this law clerk in reading the transcript.
According to the state appellate court, there was a single objection which described it as slight inflection on one occasion during the reading of her 56-page testimony. So certainly that was just one incident in a very long, extensive testimony. So it should not be weighed that heavily since it was a single instance.
You commented that, just one quick question, that it was a short time between the first trial and the second trial. Is there any record evidence as to why the trial had to be done so quickly and why more time couldn't be spent waiting to see if she showed up?
Not to my knowledge, there's nothing in the record. However, given the extensiveness and repeated efforts given here by three individuals, certainly the state appellate court, I believe, found in its opinion that there was no indication that waiting for any other period of time would have made a difference, given the fact that she had told her mother during the phone call that she had no intention to return to the city and had not identified her location. And if there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Ms. Eisner? You have 3 minutes, Ms. Eisner.
Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, As far as the demeanor evidence and her disinterested demeanor, this was concurred. Everyone agreed that she had extraordinary bizarre demeanor. There was no disagreement, and the judge said 2 minutes to answer every question. So to say that that was not that was characterizations by defense counsel is not accurate.
Now, where do you find that in the record, counsel?
It's several places.
It's
actually in several places. It's the there's a March 20. There's several colloquies. I mean, there's the March 28th hearing. Okay, so it's not going to be on that. It's going to be it may be E55 and E56, but it's going to be probably on the March. Well, it could be on the March 20th in
the
closing
argument. The unavailability hearing.
Oh yes, mm-hmm. It's absolutely in the unavailability hearing. There may be a couple on the day. Yes, it's going to be there. There it was repeated because counsel was so vigorously objecting to this. As far as counsel, a respondent says that she was, maybe they held off on the subpoena because she was frightened. That's frankly absurd. She was an adult. She wasn't a child. She was a prostitute. And this is a diligent prosecutor. It should be. I mean, they weren't diligent in this case. And that to say that that they would go light on her when they have an obligation and they're dropping the ball on their most important witness would be we don't reward their negligence for that, and we look at what they did and how they reaped a benefit. So we don't say, well, they were going light on her. That may be fine on a personal matter, but certainly as a professional matter, the Constitution isn't so fragile to say that it's sacrificed because the prosecutor is trying to be sympathetic to his adult prostitute witness. As far as taking steps, I think Your Honor's asked that. There were no affirmative steps taken to prevent her from disappearing. And that is a very important part of due diligence and the totality of the circumstances. Everything that she talked about and all she ever wants to say is what happened after she dropped the ball, after it was too late, and after they have this course of action in mind that puts on someone that supplements the demeanor. So they benefited, and my client is harmed, and we cannot countenance that kind of behavior. And finally, in terms of the proper standard that was used by the appellate court, and I think I've touched on it, but I just want to add one more point. There's a Ohio versus Roberts and a Barber rule, and nowhere was that ever stated by the appellate court. The rule is that there is a constitutional obligation to bring the accuser to trial, that face-to-face confrontation is not dispensed with lightly, that short of a futile act, all means, including formal affirmative measures, must be tried before abandoned, and that good faith may demand the effectuation in this case. There's an important quote in Ohio versus Roberts. There's a possibility, albeit remote, that affirmative measures might produce the declarant. The obligation of good faith may demand their effectuation, and nowhere was that stated by the appellate court, applied, or even in the Illinois cases that was decided. So Illinois did not even honor that silently. All they did was go through one by one. This factor isn't required. This factor is, there's no per se rule. Never did anything like it and just looked at the facts that what they did when there were leads unpursued and just discuss whether or not the beauty school was sufficient. So with that, unless there's further questions, we would ask that the writ of habeas corpus issue in this case.
Wiser, again, you accepted appointment for this case?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
Or again, thanks you as your other counsel in this this morning for your vigorous representation of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement.